Welcome to the Second Time Founders Podcast. This is the first time I'm introducing the podcast. I'm Siki, a very part-time co-host, and I'm joined by Sarah, a very long-time co-host, and the very well-known Sophia Amoroso. Really excited to have you. You've done a lot, so how do you introduce yourself these days?
Gosh, I am the founder and managing partner at Trust Fund, which is an early stage venture fund. And I have an online course called Business Class for entrepreneurs, but mostly bootstrap entrepreneurs. And what else? I have three poodles, a lot of work, and I live in Los Angeles.
Fantastic.
And I'm single, but probably not for long.
Not after appearing on this podcast.
No. Yeah, we have my founders, my dream man. You heard it here first, folks.
No, I'm
all right. Now I have a real like
no founders. How about no founders?
Side project of
how about the, no money? Because that seems to be my real.
All right. So I'll start. So the way this podcast works is we just talk about random things that we think could be useful to second-time founders.
First-time founders. We got a lot of newer folks who want to hear from us old and wise people.
You may know things from listening to this podcast, but you may not apply it until your second company. And that's okay. You know, you may retain this knowledge until you know how to actually apply it. And that's part of being a first-time founder. Listening and knowing are only a part of actually doing and executing. So expect to forget a lot of what we're saying, but it's good that you're here.
Let's start deep. You started an SEL quite a while ago, and it's been a while. What comes top of mind when you think about what do you wish you knew then? And what would you have done differently knowing that?
I started NowSeeYall, my first company, when I was 22, trying not to work for other people. And I didn't think that was entrepreneurial or ambitious. I thought it was just kind of lazy because I was bad at working for other people. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs probably find themselves in that situation in different ways in different companies. Hopefully, you're finding yourself in that position in an organization. Because I had never worked in an office before I started my company. The example of leadership was like, you clocked in, you forgot to clock out. Like that was my, you know, I had like hourly kind of retail jobs. And so what I wish I had before I started my company was experience as a leader, was experience in a workplace, experience, you know, understanding the dynamics of what a career even means, because I never meant to have one. I didn't even really know what it meant. And when I started managing people and then, holy shit, I didn't even know I was supposed to be leading them. I was really flying blind, and I didn't have any empathy, not because I'm like an unempathetic person, but because I had never had that experience, and I had never needed to be told what to do with my own business. And I thought that people I was paying more than myself would also, you know, self-diagnose and show up and cure the business of what it needed. And holding people accountable is really important, regardless if they're making, you know, 60 grand a year or 400 grand a year as your CEO. So I would say that's the biggest one. As cute and serendipitous as it is that like, oh, wow, she didn't go to college and eBay and wow, bootstrapped and unlikely story. Cool. That's inspiring. But it's like, it's not the best way to go about it. And I think experience actually matters.
I love that. I always tell people, like, you know, my first job out of college was at Google. So I got to kind of see how a successful company works. And I always tell people, like, as much as I would love to you know, convince everyone to join my startup, like probably you're going to learn more working for a company that has their shit together in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then go do your startup thing or go work for a startup. But it is really helpful to kind of see people that are amazing at their jobs and are experienced leaders and then learn from that in the beginning.
I wish the people I employed could have learned that from me.
So, you know, I'm curious with Nasty Gal, like you, it was a, just for folks who aren't aware, I'm sure a lot of people know the story, but it was a super popular, high-flying company. I mean, I think at one point you were valued at $350 million, maybe even higher. Huge brand, like the name to know, the hottest female founder to know. And then the company went bankrupt at another point. And, you know, what I'm curious about is how you would maybe in retrospect, or maybe you did the right thing, like advise founders in terms of taking chips off the table, because there isn't, everything has risk. And I think this is something I think about a lot. You know, over 8 years into this journey, I've taken nothing off the table. I've, you know, also not paid myself particularly well. And I always advise founders, like, don't do that if you can. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at some point, like as a founder, you always believe your business can be much, much bigger and you want to see the biggest outcome and you want to own as much as possible. But is there, you know, advice you would give to folks in terms of how to think about that and how to sort of de-risk your situation as you're gaining this massive valuation?
I'm sitting in this office in my house is because I took secondary in 2012. I didn't even know what that was. Before I answer your question, so funny. This has never happened. I left Nasty Gal at the end of 2016. Somebody sent a return for their like leather shorts to my mailbox, my like private mailbox here in Los Angeles.
What?
They like didn't fit. This is like a week ago. I need to return to sender. It was more than a week ago. But that's, they need a refund. Fox, they need a refund. I should just give her a refund. It would be funny. It would be funnier if I Venmo'd her.
That is amazing.
It can't be that much. So, you know, I had bootstrapped my company from nothing to a run rate of $28 million, super profitably before I raised money. I didn't like raise it. They like threw it at me because it was a freak show. Nobody does that. And it was scaling at a venture pace, even though it was a fashion business. So it like looked and smelled like a venture backable company. But at the time, you know, there wasn't a lot of, it wasn't called direct to consumer. It was called e-commerce. It was very nascent. Found.com had yet to explode, like blow up, like fail. It was like One King's Lane and Beachmint. There was no Shopify. It was like, it was a different time. You know, the people I admired were Tony Hsieh and then Natalie Massenet from NetOrder. And that was, those were my, the only people I could look to who were doing anything kind of remotely like I was. And so, yeah, Index showed up in 2012 and valued the company at $350 million. The first money in was out of a growth fund. I raised $50 million. It was Index and Thrive, and those were the only people on the cap table. Josh Kushner was like a squeaky child. I was like, Will Gabrick, they came to our office. I was like, who are you kids? And I think they're actually my age, but men tend to like read. I don't know. It's just like, who gave you all this money? How is this? And that was like, that was a real shock to the system, like both for me personally, but probably even more, well, maybe even more so to the business, because the company wasn't set up to absorb the expectations and I think almost like the accountability and speed of execution that had happened naturally for me because I kept my head down and just kept giving people what they wanted and shipped it on time and gave them good customer service. It's not that hard, but when you raise $50 million, when you raise it a $350 million valuation, the expectation is next time you raise, it's going to be at over $1 billion, hoping that people still want to invest in like fashion e-commerce, you know? And so trends can change, you know, what, you know, you're building, Sarah. I don't know the market of what you're building. I think marketplaces are brilliant and I love investing in them.
Well, the good thing about childcare is kids seem to be a thing that doesn't go out of style. People have to keep having them for our society to exist. So
I know. I liked more of them.
Durable.
You know, it's like in 2 years, something could be unsexy. Venture capital has changed their minds. BuzzFeed, Vice, like, why did we do that? We don't invest in media anymore. We're overallocated in that, you know, sector. And then you're like, you know, oh shit, you know, I'm Vice and I need to raise money, but actually we're valued like a venture company, but we're not. And so raising a high valuation can really fuck you. I didn't know that raising a 10x plus valuation in 2012 would be kind of like an early nail in the coffin. It took me a really long time to figure that out. But that can happen when you raise too high of a valuation. I didn't have competing term sheets. It was like negotiating at a flea market. Danny was like, this much for this much. And I was like, this much for this much. And you were like, okay. And it was like over the phone. And then I got a term sheet. I didn't have to raise money. And, you know, it was when I met Jeff Jordan. He flew to LA in 2012 to come to our offices. Same thing with like Jeremy Liu. And it was amazing just to even start building a network of, you know, top tier, like Jeff and Jeremy are both LPs trust fund now. So it was a really, really valuable thing to do, both in that I was able to take secondary, which wound up being like the only money I've ever made, other than like a book, which was like such a fraction of that. And that I was able to kind of seed these relationships that have become really valuable and people who have become mentors at the time. There's more reasons than just funding a company, I think, to take venture capital if you have a really good firm. And Index was a really good firm. And, you know, Drew Houston and Dick Costolo and, you know, all of these amazing, you know, folks were sitting at like the poker table with me in, you know, maybe 2013 at Calistoga Ranch at the Index offsite. And like, that's a whole different kind of value. Ultimately, you know, that shock to the system, even operationally, became something where it was like, oh shit, we had to hire 100 people in a year. The expectation was literally, I had like a COO, I had top tier, you know, venture investor on my board, only person on my board other than me until almost the end, saying, let's round up by 100 million. And so our goal for the next year was 128 million, not 129, not 122, literally just rounded up by $100 million and hired over 100 people. Eventually built it to over $100 million in revenue, not profitably, with bloat and dollar a piece business cards because our art director was like snobby. And I had no idea what I was fucking doing. And it was the best ride, the most fun. I've had the most fun, but also something that, like, you know, I couldn't see past what I was doing and didn't know how to fucking lead people. So in terms of taking chips off the table, that was supposed to be like child's play compared to what I was going to make.
Right.
So I didn't take 50 million off the table, but the company didn't need to raise money. I owned 80% of the company when it was worth $350 million.
Right.
So on paper, I was worth so much that like the money I had taken was just like, oh, cool. This is just like, you know, this is just like funny money that I'll start blowing as if I'm worth, you know, $280 million.
Right.
Which is not blown. I have a lot of equity in my home. And I still need to work, which is probably a good thing because I'd be a freak if I had probably made that much money or more. Like, I just wonder whose boat I would be on. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's something I think a founder should consider doing when you've already built something, largely on merit and not because you can raise it a high valuation. Optimizing for ownership, I think, is just kind of dumb. Like, you could own 10% of a business, and if you build it with the right people and the right investors that are valuing you at something that's reasonable along the way, even with taking that dilution, you are setting yourself up to, you know, hit realistic milestones and be able to raise money at, you know, at a price that you haven't priced yourself out of with a prior round. So thinking long term and not and ignoring the glamour of a crazy valuation is really important. Because you have to know what happens next for you to be able to raise again. And you're probably going to blow a lot of money getting there. And just to finish, what's cool is that the valuations that entrepreneurs are seeing now are a lot more in line, you know, though for the most part, maybe outside of like AI or something, like keep them accountable just by the nature of the market right now. And the word profitability is now like, that was not a, after they invested, that was just not a word. That's not a word I ever heard in the venture world. So it's cool and encouraging, to hear that word. And as someone who very substantially bootstrapped a business, something that who knew now as a venture investor, it's something that I understand, which I think probably very few of us do.
I really resonated with what you're saying about optimizing for ownership. That's like, seems like a really common first time founder mistake. And the way I explain it is these are kind of binary outcomes. Half of a really large amount of money is still a large amount of money. And 100% of $0 is still $0. And you want to optimize for making it work.
Yeah, I was on the cover of Forbes and I was richer than Beyonce.
It's amazing. I think for the benefit of most of our listeners, I just imagine when you're a first-time founder and something is starting to work and someone is handing you a check for a lot of money. So we actually share an investor. Jeremy Liu also invested in my first company, and I also have $0 in a bank and offer me secondary, which I took in that first company. And I just remember thinking, here's a person who's giving me a lot of money. What did it feel like in the moment? And how do you think a founder first time around can make wiser decisions than you did or even I did during or after the fundraising process?
I mean, just don't do it early on. Like, I invested in Pipe, and I'm pretty sure like Harry Hurst is buying lattes with some his secondary, you know, like that was a crazy valuation and something I like regret investing in.
You and I went
as an angel. I don't think it's like a great look. I think you should have, you got to have built something first. If somebody offers it to you, great. But like, don't be greedy. Like, good things come in time, and you won't understand why you have these things if you haven't built something that when you look at your bank account makes sense. And I don't think it ever makes sense when you make a shitload of money and you didn't have a shitload of money before that. I mean, it was like dive bars and burritos. And then it was like, you know, I'm buying the table wine and oysters on me or whatever, you know, and it was like, oh, I'm going to buy a mattress. I'm going to get a $30,000 fucking horsehair mattress, which was great, but it's in storage now because my ex wanted like something Tempur-Pedic. So I, you know, when you do make money, I'd say just like don't spend it. I think a lot of people are good at that. I inflated my life. I have three poodles because I had a fucking full-time housekeeper and a shut-in husband. You know, like I have to deal with three poodles now and I live alone. it's fine. They're awesome, but it's like nuts. So don't build your life assuming that everything's going to work out, because chances are it's not. And if it does, awesome, but keep your feet on the ground. Like,
I feel like the meta here is that, you know, we are people with more experience than we had before. I remember when I didn't have experience, it was hard to appreciate even the value of experience. I actually actively devalued experience. I thought, you know, I'm young, I have a fresh perspective, and
yeah, I can just like
parts with experience with the suits. I don't need them.
Just like
paint. And yeah. And now do you have some, you're like, oh, experience is super valuable, right? And I guess like the meta question here is that, you know, when you don't have a lot of experience, how do you even learn to appreciate the value of experience?
Yeah. I mean, if to answer your last question, because I feel like I didn't, what did it feel like to make that money? It was surreal. I paid a lot in taxes and I paid off my mom's mortgage. Like, what else am I going to do? You know, I bought a house so I could have like friends over and swim. Like, I took friends on trips. Like, if having money is like by yourself is like whatever, being able to take your friend to fucking Amangiri for her birthday, that's amazing, which I can't do anymore. Probably because I did that. But like, you know, going to the south of France with a friend and buying matching Hermes scarves like a dork, you know, before you get on the plane at duty free. It's just like amazing. But like, so it's amazing. It's amazing. But just, you know, be careful what you do with your money and don't get too excited about yourself and whatever. Keep your head down and keep working. In terms of your last question, okay, can you ask it again?
Yeah. I mean, how do you appreciate the value of experience when you don't?
Yeah. I mean, experience is only as good as what you do with it and as good as what the people you hire do with it. And experience is only as good as how well you hold the people who have experience around you do with it. I don't know how to finish that sentence, but you get it. Like, experience is great. Experience can be, you know, living out, like showing up and, you know, living out your past when you give advice to other people and not tempering it with the fact that like, that's your story. Or when you take advice from experienced people, knowing that they're just speaking through like a very specific filter and experience, and their damage isn't your damage and it may not be your experience. So just like always understanding the caveat of like, you know, everyone's had like probably a pretty wildly different experience, but there are like truisms, I guess. And I think what we're talking about are a lot of them, and I don't want to be like, I'm right, we know, right? But like, that's why people listen to podcasts, because we're supposed to. But there are, but those things are real. And that's not like based on one founder's experience. We're talking about taking money off the table. We're talking about, you know, ownership and valuations and choosing investors and the value of experience. And like, those aren't like, those are opinions and shared experiences that many, many founders share. So I'd say
Paul Buchheit's definition of experience.
No,
it's like Paul Buchheit's kind of Gmail. It's my favorite one. He has this equation. Experience equals limited life experiences plus overgeneralizations equals experience.
Yeah, there's a quote. There's a quote, and you can like edit this for a second. Have you heard of this song by the director Baz Luhrmann called Sunscreen?
Nope.
And it's really beautiful. It's better if you just read it, because it's not like good music. And it's something he read at a, like some kind of, he wrote and read at a.
Yeah. This was like a very popular song for a while.
I didn't know about it until this man sent it to me and read it out loud to me, which was kind of cool. But he says, advice is, let's see here. Okay. Be careful whose advice you buy, but be patient with those who supply it. Advice is a form of nostalgia. Dispensing it is a way of fishing the past from the disposal, wiping it off, painting over the ugly parts, and recycling it for more than it's worth.
Ooh.
It's really good.
Ooh.
Like sunscreen.
Oh, that's it.
I feel like this is a good segue into what you're doing now, which is you've kind of transitioned to the dark side. No, I'm just joking. We love VCs. But you have a fund now called Trust Fund, which I imagine is a kind of play on, you know, making fun of trust funds and people who have them. But, you know, how is it different than the, you know, the average VC bro or, you know, how maybe you love VCs and you think they're all amazing and you want to be just like them. Tell us about that.
I'm doomed and possessed not to be like them. I'm not like committed to not being like them because the majority of VC like bros, I guess, that I've met, like don't really seem like bros to me. I know that's like a trope, but lots of people I've met through venture are like incredibly like nurturing mentors. And I don't know if it's just because I'm a girl and they think it's like, oh, or something, but like the venture world like runs on like virtue and like sharing and giving other people access and, you know, giving giving entrepreneurs the benefit of the doubt and the opportunity to like build something incredible that could change the world and give people, you know, a marketplace where they can make money and they can go to work and have their child cared for. Like without a platform like that, like you're like, that's life changing for two sides of the equation. I mean, you know this, but like, it's like what software can do is, it's like such a beautiful thing. And I'm not like a, you know, I'm not like an engineer and I built a consumer business, but I was also the end user of a product like eBay that completely changed my life. So I haven't experienced that. And, you know, people like Rob Hayes, who's also an LP, or, you know, Jeff Jordan, like are guys that I've just like sat with and not like ever pitched really. I think I pitched Andreessen once, but Jeff wasn't in the room. That was cool. Being told no by Andreessen was like better than being told yes by anybody else. Like just being in that room for me, he was like, being like a weird fan, having like, you know, Mark and Ben there, and Mark's also an LP, and so is Chris. And okay, I'll stop.
Oh my.
we're cool. We're lucky. We're rare. And it also doesn't mean we're good at our jobs. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to raise a $30 million round from those guys. I got to go. People.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have this perception of venture capitalists are like, just these rich dudes that are dispensing money. But at the end of the day, like VCs have a job to do. They take money from their LPs and they have to invest it in companies they think are going to return the fund and then some. They're not, you know, bad guys out for blood. They're actually enabling all this kind of innovation that can't happen in any other industry because you don't have these, you know, big infusions of capital like you see in venture. So I agree. Like they're not bad guys. They're good guys. They're all part of the ecosystem and on our side. And I think, you know, there historically has been a lack of diversity, which I think has contributed to this bad rap, but we're starting to see more incredible women and diverse investors rise to the top. We have a number of, you know, women, we have majority women on our cap table. So I'm lucky to kind of have amazing investors that I can really relate to. But yeah, I think you're right. Like these are amazing people that are enabling great innovation to happen.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was going to say that I think that's not a popular belief with first time founders in particular. There's this like weird internal power dynamic feeling. Yeah. And that actually doesn't help founders raise money, right? Like I think the more helpful and I think actually correct way of thinking about the investor relationship is they actually have a much tougher job than you in any given fundraising meeting. Because if their job to sell you as a founder, their liquid US dollar that buys the same shit as everyone else's liquid US dollar. And yeah, I think like we, a lot of founders come into this with this like weird power dynamic feeling of like insecurity and somewhat of a chip on their shoulder, and it ends up not being productive for either party.
And I, the one thing I'll say that even the coolest, most helpful investors can be guilty of is the fact that there's just a conflict of interest. They've got bosses and they want to retain, you know, the valuation that they invested in your company at, which ultimately, you know, we wound up in, you know, valuation purgatory and then cock blocked for like, you know, down rounds, which was, you know, not even at with a vote, yeah, but kind of like spiritually in conversations that I wasn't privy to, where like a possible awesome investors like kind of vanished because they weren't willing to pay $350 million. And this is because when your venture investor, you know, shows up at their AGM, which is their big conference presentation for their LPs, or the people giving them money, it's in their best interest to show that what they invested in is at worst still worth what it was before. And that can really starve you out. Or it's in their best interest. I mean, and it's even more in their best interest that they've marked up their investment. And what value means is like debatable, or what something's worth is debatable when there's like, you know, largely one party setting a price for something, and it's their job to make your company more expensive than it was when they put in their first check. And that's something just to be really aware of as you, you know, get term sheets and, you know, valuations and take advice on whether to or to not raise money and how much to, and at what price.
Yeah, I think the that like understanding the motivations is really key. And I think investors, ooh, do we lose Siki? Hopefully he's coming right back.
Should we just wait a second? Okay.
Riverside is good at kind of stitching everything together. He's back and better than ever.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Weird power issue.
I think investors are generally like incentivized to, you know, see how big a company can get as quickly as possible. They have a portfolio approach, and, you know, founders have one company, and they're incentivized to make that thing as valuable as possible ultimately, but not at the expense of dying, because that's their only shot at goal. And so, you know, I've been fortunate that I think my investors are really aligned with where we are, and early stage investors tend to be more aligned on the grand scheme of things. But, you know, there is that tension between like, I want this thing to last forever and be a long standing company that, you know, my kids use when they have children, and my investors, you know, need to return the fund. I get that tension is always going to be there.
And also, you know, they have a lot of founders they're supporting. And when you're not the winner, they're not going to fix your company for you.
Right.
So like their nature and a lot of like their responsibility in some ways is to focus on the companies that are doing better. And some of them just aren't. The majority of them won't. And so some of them are going to dig in and, you know, deal with the bloodbath that now happening because all their companies raised at like way too high of a valuation 2 years ago. And some of them are going to do that and stop deploying and dig in and, you know, preserve what they've invested in and what you've built. But other ones are going to go spend time with the founders and the companies that are the most promising, because they're not going to fix it for you. And that's what happened to me. And as much as I hated it, you know, I wonder what's going to happen when you know, my portfolio, there's, you know, some of them are killing it and raising, you know, rounds, and, you know, I can be really helpful. What I can't be helpful with is turning a company around. Clearly, mine went fucking bankrupt. So, like, that's, I'm not investing. Like, I'm investing in the early stage because it's what I'm good at. And I think I'll want to be like upfront increasingly with founders as I invest in them, that if, you know, if things plateau or go sideways, like, I'm going to be as helpful as I can with what I am capable of, but I may not like be there for you in 5 years because I've got a whole bunch of other early stage companies and I'm, you know, not investing at you as Series C, and you've got a whole bunch of other shit that, like, at this point, I'm probably not even that privy to because you're like reporting to investors who wrote you way bigger checks.
It's kind of interesting.
There's a mercenary element to the job. It's fucking money. It's your job to return money. So there's that.
Yeah. When the SVB bank collapse happened a year ago, which is now ancient history for everyone, our company was entirely, all of our money was in SVB. And we didn't have access to it and we couldn't make payroll and, you know, all the drama. But, you know, when shit hit the fan, like, my investors certainly rolled up their sleeves and were like, look, we got to figure out how to help you. But in the interim, I put the whole company on my credit cards and I looked in my personal bank account and I was like, is there anyone else who's opening up their personal bank account to me right now? And like, that was kind of the wake-up call for me that we need to get profitable, because ultimately it's on me. And this is like, I'm the only one that will die for this business. Probably no one else will give their life savings or their life to this. And I think that's right. Like, investors shouldn't. That would be crazy. You have a portfolio to think about. You have, you know, all your kids to live for. But, you know, you got to realize that tension.
Yeah,
we'll be there.
And I also think, like, it's a lot easier for an investor to justify digging in and supporting when there's like a macro thing going on, like SVB or the economy shifting, when like your company is just tanking.
It's like, you know, it depends on like what's going on and how unique your like struggle is.
I think
what's interesting to me is you were able to maintain, like, even though you kind of had this experience of sort of everyone disappearing when shit hit the fan, you've maintained these relationships. And now, you know, these people are your LPs and you obviously really like them and respect them. And, you know, I think that's pretty rare that you were able to kind of maintain good relationships.
It was really only indexed on my cap table. So my experience is indexed.
But are they now LPs, like the people from Index?
Losing money is also part of their job. So the folks in my, you know, I thought I'd be this like pariah, but Lightspeed lent, you know, the seed round in my next company, which was called Girl Boss. So, it's like not everybody bails, but, you know, maybe the folks on your cap table will spend their time elsewhere. And I kind of don't blame them.
I think there's like a difference between, you know, naturally, if a company is doing less well, you know, you're going to spend, given the companies are doing great, a lot more attention. That makes sense. I think there's a difference between that and just like bad behavior in when things are going well. Like, if you have a lifeline to a round of bridge funding and they're blocking it, that's just like straight up bad behavior.
Right.
And I think like for a first-time founder, that's really important to suss out, right? Because, you know, what you quickly learn is that when things are going well, everyone's great. Everyone is the nicest, your best buddy. But like when shit hits a fan, you see shit, right? Like on my second company, when we were shutting down, it was stark how the best investors, how they went out of their way to be supportive than they have to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't expect that from every investor, but the ones that you expected, you know, you were close to, ended up making it so difficult and optimizing every dollar and penny. And knowing that upfront is like highly valuable to you as a founder when you're raising.
And honestly, you know, we're talking about optimizing for ownership, like just own your company and that'll never happen. Like if you control your business, that's just not going to happen. So that's, I guess on the flip side, it's like bootstrap it as far as you can, sell a minority stake and run the show.
Yeah, that's right. You know, when you are on that other side of the table, what are you looking for in a founder that is different and informed by your set of experiences as a founder?
I love second time founders. So everyone who's listening, just go fuck up and then call me. Just give it a I love second time founders. I've got like two of my co-founders in one company called Agree, which is this amazing like legal tech platform they're building. Are both three times founder. They both have three exits independently under their belts. Like that's insane. You know, I look for people who are like beasts, you know, I want to know that this person's going to show up and do what it takes when things aren't great. Like, I want to say like work-life balance and shit like that, but it's like, no, don't raise venture capital if you expect work-life balance. And I know that's like toxic, but I'm just gonna like, I just still can't, I'm not gonna give people like, you know, bullshit advice. Like you have to be someone who's confident, can raise money, can, you know, be charismatic enough or Asperger's-y and brilliant enough to like, you know, convince people in the room that what you're building is going to be really special. And I think people who are like really, who feel like a deep, like have a deep understanding of or experience with what it is that they're building and ideally have felt pain. And so in my LP deck, I summarize that by killers building painkillers.
I love it. Wow. I got to use that for my next pitch deck.
I like almost haven't shared it because it's so good.
Really good. Now we're all going to see, like, you're going to see that in everyone's deck now.
It is now on my Twitter. That is my thing now.
It's the new bio.
You can amplify it.
We'll give you credit.
Thank you.
We don't plagiarize. You can get in trouble now for plagiarizing, I hear.
So yeah, you do a lot of pitches now. I imagine from a lot of first-time founders too. What do people get wrong about fundraising, the process, the pitch?
I mean, there's a company I passed on, came out of YC. It's a $25 million valuation. They've hardly built anything. Really smart founders. Great experience. Their deck was like six slides long and they had no articulation of go to market. And it was like pre-seed at like a seed plus valuation. And that's just like, there are people who are going to invest, but like, again, ownership, price, like you want me, give me the last round's valuation. And that has happened a few times. But I think like, oh, showing up and being like overconfident, being confident is important, but like being like almost like just not their level of confident is like, and that's kind of, that's a little bro-y and I haven't seen a ton of it, but when I do, it's like, where's the knock, knock, like, where's the person? And I like need to see the person. You know,
the person
I want
that is probably insecure.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool when they can show up and answer any question I have or say like, let me get back to you. Like the more they know, the better. And then be able to articulate like, all right, well, how's this a $1 billion company? Because you can bootstrap this or raise money from a different kind of investor, but like we're here to take big swings and build, you know, crazy shit that's going to change, you know, the lives of a lot of families, right? Like there's a lot of families what you're building. So I think like audacious, but not overconfident, and not greedy. really understand what it is that they're doing, not just because it's like an opportunity, like, but have an understanding of what they're doing, not because of like a statistic or some research, but because they could really understand it. Ideally, like on a cellular level, ideally on a traumatic level. Like if building a company can be therapeutic, like,
yeah,
I think it's called a chip on your shoulder, whichever, whatever it is, like, let it run.
Well, I think we're almost out of time. Are there any parting words or thoughts or things we didn't cover that we should have?
You can pitch me at trustfund.vc. Really helpful. Like this job. What else?
Can people pitch you that don't have a warm intro?
Yeah, I invested in, I like was the first check into that company I just mentioned with those three time founders who submitted and I look at all of them, but I was like, how do founders, why would, which is mean I'm doing a good job marketing. Yeah, I mean, get in any way that you can. Warm intros are nice, but articulate what it is that you're doing well. So when someone clicks on your deck, they want it. That's the main thing. It's like, know what you're doing and know how to articulate it and then send it to me.
Amazing. How else can people find you on the internet?
Well, there's some naked photos really, really deep in the internet. Just kidding.
Shark web.
And whatever. At Sophia Amoruso, probably spelled out somewhere on where you're finding this podcast.
Yes.
On everything. Trust funds, like, I don't know, trustfund.vc on Instagram, trustfundvc on Twitter.
What's your air chat?
Do you know about air chat?
I don't know.
You gotta get
on. No, I have it. I'm like, okay. What?
I already churned. I got a new phone yesterday and I did not migrate over to my new phone.
I like listening to Naval talk, but I can do that anywhere. Like, what else? Yeah, that's it. I have a newsletter. You can go to sophiaamoruso.com/newsletter and check it out. And then send me an email.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I was like, I should give you my email address. It's just team@trustfund.vc. I'm great. All of it. I'll just pretend like that's my email address.
Love it.
Well, thanks so much for coming on, Sophia.
Thank you. It's fun. Always, always fun.
All right.